You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 16th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Tim Kuhner, professor of law, on his new book, Capitalism versus Democracy, Money in Politics, and the Free Market Constitution. Also on the program today, paycheck fairness bill blocked, because come on, the ladies. Speaking of the ladies, Rush Limbaugh has an interesting definition of what no means. It means yes. If you know how to spot it. Just a couple of days away from the big independence vote in Scotland, Great Britain, maybe a little bit less great. In Texas, the right-wingers now also want to get rid of that whole thing about climate change in their science books, echoing ISIS's call for the same belief system. In New Zealand, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, and Kim.com have their moment of truth. The U.S. set to send 3,000 troops to the African continent to fight Ebola, which is now reaching epidemic proportions. This past August, the warmest on record. But what's the big deal? We hear that about almost every other month. And Mark Sanford shows how to break up with your soulmate. No, it's not texting, folks. You don't do it through a text. And finally, the story of another NFL player, Vikings Adrian Peterson, indicted for child abuse. Just a horrible story. And it has, I don't even think you can call that spanking. I happen to think that spanking is ineffective and can be brutal. But this guy apparently hit his four-year-old and has done it to multiple sons with a stick, causing lacerations across the kid's face, his genitals, all over his body. If that's not child abuse, I'm sorry. I don't know what is, but we will talk more about that as the show continues. This story, as people are starting to slowly turn their attention to the Chicago mayor's race, which may or may not include Karen Lewis, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union, against Rahm Emanuel. Nearly half of the principals In the Chicago Public Schools Principals has responded to a survey by the Chicago Principals and Administrators Association, said that ever since the school district awarded $340 million in two custodial management contracts in February, less than a year ago, custodial services were privatized, ostensibly to save money and improve service. Principals reported serious problems with rodents, roaches, other bugs, filthy floors, overflowing garbage bins, filthy toilets, missing supplies such as toilet paper and soap, and broken furniture. Issues they said they didn't have before. Now, they said, they spend a lot of time trying to clean their buildings. Three-year contracts were awarded to Aramark for $260 million and Sodex Magic, $80 million. To clean Chicago schools. At the time, the district school spokesman, Joel Hood, issued a statement saying the contracts would give measurable benefits that will make the schools, quote, significantly cleaner while saving the district tens of millions of dollars. That's why it's called Sodex Magic. 475 custodians who work under the management of Aramark out of the district's force of 2,500 are going to be laid off, even though they are obviously woefully understaffed. One more example of why Rahm Emanuel is a horrible person and maybe a worse mayor, and how privatization rarely, rarely works on any accord. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Tim Kuhner. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Tim Kuhner, professor of law at the Georgia State University College of Law and author of the newly released Capitalism versus Democracy, Money in Politics and the Free Market Constitution. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam, and please call me Tim.
Tim. All right. Great. You've written a very helpful basically tracking the change in our approach to campaign finance, specifically via the Supreme Court over the past really, I guess, 40 years now. And let's just start with the notion of how you think campaign finance and the idea, the relationship between money and politics, was contemplated in the Constitution and at our founding?
I don't think it was contemplated in any depth at the time. Campaigns were not nearly as expensive as they are today. In fact, it doesn't even make sense to compare them. The nature of our country at the time of its independence was agrarian. I mean, we hadn't even gone through the Industrial Revolution yet, never mind the mass media revolution. So the campaign finance scandals back in the 1700s had to do with candidates spending some of their own money to buy their supporters cakes and ale, that sort of thing, in order to get people out to the polls to vote. It wasn't the wholesale conversion of politics into an economic marketplace with all of these different donors and spenders and investors. So at the time, the concerns that were had back then were much more pressing, and they were about other issues, right? Could we keep the English away? Could we keep the French and the Spanish away? Could we separate powers? Could we separate church and state? What were we going to do about slavery and so on?
And I mean, I think that, you know, that takes us up on some level to this confluence between the notion of democracy and the notion of so-called free market capitalism, which is it fair to say this is basically this confluence happens around Buckley v. Vallejo, And if so, where were we before Buckley v. Vallejo, before we talk about that case?
Before Buckley v. Vallejo, we were at a pivotal, and I mean pivotal moment in U.S. history, which is the confrontation of the country and specifically the U.S. Congress with the question of whether economic power should be the new means of political exclusion. So we were fresh off of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. We were fresh off the abolition of poll taxes through the 24th Amendment. And there was this moment in the 1970s where the question was, would the democratic evolution continue to allow meaningful democracy for more and more people to the point at which ordinary Americans could exercise meaningful political power? And that's what Rawls was writing about in 1971 in his Theory of Justice. He talked about how the theory of our Constitution ought to be that those who are similarly endowed and motivated should have the same chance of obtaining positions of political authority, regardless of their economic and social class. So we were in that kind of a pivotal, my goodness, this is going to be an awkward interview, I can tell already, moment in U.S. history. And that's when, also at the same time that Rawls was writing, the U.S. Congress was drafting the Federal Election Campaign Act. And that act, which was the first comprehensive reform of campaign finance in the United States, contained eventually limits on donations and limits on expenditures. And so, and the other thing going on in the 70s, of course, was Milton Friedman and his movement, right, from these sort of unpopular economic views coming out of entitlement programs and coming out of the post-World War II era where the middle class was growing and capitalism was becoming more accessible for people. Coming out of that process, Milton Friedman pushed back against the government, pushed back against regulation, pushed back against entitlements, and sort of developed this faith in free markets as wiser and better than government. So all of that was going on, and when the Supreme Court entered the scene in Buckley in 1976, they had to choose between Milton Friedman and Rawls, and they chose Friedman.
All right. Well, tell us about what was the Buckley v. Vallejo case?
Buckley v. Vallejo is the case in which FECA, the Federal Election Campaign Act, which was passed throughout the 70s before and after Watergate, was challenged by Senator Buckley. And the court had to consider the constitutionality mainly of donation limits, so that individual donors couldn't contribute more than $1,000 and something at the time, and expenditure limits, which were binding on candidates and outside parties and so on. So the idea, Congress was very clear in its goals behind FECA, and the goals consisted in combating corruption and the appearance of corruption, equalizing the relative ability of all citizens to affect the outcome of elections. That's a big one, right? Political equality. And three, slowing the skyrocketing costs of political campaigns, opening the political system more widely to candidates without access to sources of large amounts of money. So the congressional purposes are very much in line with Rawls's idea of a republic in which even a poor person or a middle-class person could be an equal citizen in comparison to a wealthy person. And so Congress was on board with that, but the Supreme Court really wasn't. And so the Buckley case produced the first, what I call acts of alchemy, right? Really converting one thing into another. And so the Burger Court in Buckley converts money into speech. And they say, we've never held that the funding of speech accomplishes anything like reducing the constitutional protections available for political speech. And so they really say the funding of it is irrelevant, whether it's big money or small money or what have you. The fact that it's money doesn't affect the product being produced, which is speech. And so they equate money with speech. And Buckley also does a really important thing in saying that political equality is a goal that is wholly foreign to the First Amendment, which was one of Congress's goals, right, to restrict the speech of some elements of our society to enhance the relative voice of others. The court in Buckley says that's wholly foreign to the First Amendment.
And I mean, give me your sense of that, because, I mean, what we're talking about here is speech a dynamic, or does it exist in sort of a vacuum, right? I mean, that's if... Right. I mean, that's the that's the question in terms of what the First Amendment is about.
Yeah, the court sees speech as just existing, and once speech has been uttered, it's sacred, and it doesn't matter whether that speech has been uttered and publicized through corporate general treasury funds or by the lady, your neighbor, right, who's out in the town plaza saying, I have this sincerely held viewpoint that I'd like to communicate to you, my fellow citizens. The court sees absolutely no difference. And in the McCutcheon case, which was decided just this past April, the court says that when donors and spenders use their money to produce political speech, they're producing protected forms of political expression and political association. And the court says, quote, those rights are important regardless of whether the individual is a lone pamphleteer or street corner orator in the Tom Paine mold, or is someone who spends substantial amounts of money in order to communicate his political ideas through sophisticated means. So there you have it, right? Tom Paine is just identical to one of the Koch brothers in their view.
Now, and we should just say, McCutcheon is the case that basically blew off the aggregate limits that could be given by an individual to races across the country. And there's a lot of sort of loopholes. It imagines that money isn't fungible. There's a lot of problems with it. We'll get to that in a bit. But so now from your perspective, is the problem with that interpretation of the First Amendment, is that problematic, or is it that there is no, I mean, we do constrain speech in this country when there is an overriding societal concern, right? I mean, you can't right. yell fire in a crowded theater is the most obvious one. But so at what point is the question of their interpretation of the First Amendment problematic, or is it their question of whether or not there is a compelling reason to constrain that speech?
The court has both problems. Their interpretation of the First Amendment is unjustified in terms of the history of the First Amendment and the level of specificity contained in that amendment. So Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Well, what does the freedom of speech mean, and what does abridging mean? Because in the Bennett case and the Davis case, which are cases about the financing of campaigns, whether there can be public financing that's effective, whether there can be advantages for publicly financed candidates when they're facing off against very wealthy candidates, the court has said that very effective forms of public financing are unconstitutional because they diminish the effectiveness of private speech, by which they mean private donations and expenditures from the very rich. So the court has read that clause about Congress shall not make any law abridging the freedom of speech to be a hypersensitive needle. And when you diminish the incentives for market transactions, for spending and donating on political goods and services, you've now violated the First Amendment. And so that kind of interpretation is problematic per se.
All right, I want to just stop there and just to sort of walk people through that, because it's really important. Because in that instance, they are not saying that speech is in a vacuum, right? Because we're talking about campaign finance laws that would sort of kick in extra money if you were running. That would basically equal the playing field if you're if someone you're running against is privately funded beyond even where the original public financing contemplated. And so in that instance, they're perceiving speech as being a dynamic, right? That you are diminishing this millionaire's voice if the government goes in and provides more campaign funding for someone who's running on a publicly financed campaign, because then all of a sudden speech is relative, right? I mean, that's the contradiction.
Exactly. So that's why the court is really doing both things. On the one hand, they're maintaining and telling us that a privatized marketplace for speech has to be protected. And the Supreme Court sees that as its role. So when the government intervenes into this privatized market and subsidizes the publicly financed candidate, even though the government's only injecting more money in the market, and even though the government's not limiting private spenders or donors in that case, it's interrupting what the court sees as a sacred, natural level of private funding. And if you interrupt that, you can't expect markets to do their job.
I mean, in that instance, it seems to me that it's protecting a notion of the free market as opposed to the notion of speech.
That's right. And again, this is exactly why the court is making every kind of mistake you can imagine. First off, they see money as speech, and they look at it in this sort of deontological, like very pure, this is a right in and of itself, and it doesn't matter what the consequences are. But they also make the other mistake and say, this right is located within an economic market, and that's how we know what its function is, right? The right of free speech is maintaining open markets as opposed to regulated markets. And so that's an instrumental take, which seeks to accomplish certain outcomes by protecting the right. So the court will throw every legal theory and every legal mechanism at you to make sure that private capital remains effective and powerful. That's the function of what they're doing, if not their intention as well.
And when we say the court, we should note that it seems that all of these major sort of landmark cases, we go from Buckley v. Valeo and we go to from the First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, where in fact Rehnquist fell on the side that I think most people who listen to this program would be sympathetic to, in terms of the idea that you can actually constrict the spending of corporations when it comes to, in this case, it was ballot initiatives. These have not been slam dunks, right? They've all been more or less 5-4. Is that basically the case?
That's right. And in fact, there was greater support during the Rehnquist court years for cases that limited money and that limited corporate power, like Austin. Austin was a 6-3 case. And Austin is the case that protects against undue influence of aggregate corporate economic power, right? And that is affirmed in McConnell. And then with less support than those other cases, it's struck down in Citizens United. So the Roberts Court majority is on the shakiest of footings. It's the narrowest majority you can get on the court.
And when we get to Citizens United, there the issue is less about freedom and abridging, right, when it comes to free speech, and more about the idea that there isn't a compelling state reason to do this.
Yes, and that's also what the court does in McCutcheon. They say because political speech is so important, it triggers strict or at least intermediate scrutiny, so the government, in order to limit political speech, meaning, well, corporate general treasury spending or private donations or what have you, the Congress and has to have a compelling state interest, or at least a sufficient, at least a very important one. And what the court is doing in Citizens United and Buckley, by the way, is saying that most of the interests you could come up with, like political equality and democratic integrity or protecting the time of elected office holders so they don't have to fundraise all day, that those kinds of rationales are all insufficient to justify restricting so-called speech. And so the only thing that now justifies restrictions on private spending and donating is the prevention of corruption, by which they mean quid pro quo, bribery-style corruption, not other dynamics that everyone in the world understands to be corrupt.
All right, so let's just start. I mean, and explain to people, when you say strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny, just explain what that means to the. I'm sure there's one or two people in our audience who doesn't know what that means at this point.
Yeah, sure. So this refers to court-created tests. So when a legislature is restricting a constitutionally protected right, the court will have to make a decision as to whether the legislature has a good reason for doing that, or whether the legislature is just arbitrarily restricting rights. So if rights aren't absolute, then it follows that under certain circumstances, government can limit them. So what you have, for example, are different levels of scrutiny depending on the importance of the right. And political speech is considered, as well as political association, are considered to be of the utmost importance. So what you have in strict scrutiny, which is what I would argue the law is, there's a little bit of unclarity on this point, but generally speaking, what the court is looking for is a compelling state interest to justify the restriction of political speech, by which it means spending or donating. And so it scrutinizes, it really, it pays very strict attention to why Congress or a state legislature has chosen to regulate campaign finance. So when they're looking for very important or compelling state interests, they're citing the drafting history of the law or the text of the law and saying, does this interest in political equality or this interest in reducing the costs of elections or this interest in preventing bribery, do these interests suffice to warrant a restriction on a constitutional right? And that's where Citizens United, McCutcheon, and even Buckley are very notable cases, because they really restrict and really reduce the realm of reasons or motivations that any lawmaking body could have for regulating campaign financing. So we're down now to a state of the law in which the only thing you can really attempt to do as a regulator is root out actual bribery. And so if you can't connect a law to actual bribery and the prevention of actual bribery, then that law is going to fail if it restricts expenditures or donations.
Now, and so that is, I mean, that part where they make the determination that notions like fairness of outcomes or the concentration of power as it's manifested through someone's ability to buy an election or influence the outcome of an election with a lot of money, that just doesn't meet the standard. That entire issue, whether or not that's the case, whether or not we accept the facts that, you know, Sam Cedar can walk in with his millions of dollars and buy the mayor's race in New York City, that's irrelevant. They move on to the question of as to whether or not, it seems to me, in Citizens United, which also stuck out to me in Citizens United, was the question of whether or not this creates corruption narrowly defined, or the appearance of corruption. And that to me seems like a finding of fact that the court ruled on. I think it was Kennedy who famously said, I don't see it. And I think this is how they also sort of rejected, I think it was North Dakota's law, or maybe it was Montana's, in terms of corporate money. Is that not a finding of fact? And they didn't seem to really dig around much for that fact.
Yeah, they actually don't require a great deal of evidence to show that First Amendment rights have been violated. Now, that's the other part of the equation. You're talking about the part of the equation being, is there corruption, right? And is there corruption to be prevented? And the court, I mean, in McCutcheon, they say that even these $3.6 million amounts that individual donors can now contribute, the implication is that even those $3.6 million amounts from each individual donor wouldn't actually produce quid pro quo corruption. And they held that the $123,000 limit, which was the prior limit, the one that they struck down, that that limit wasn't related to the prevention of corruption because no voter, no office holder or candidate would be corrupted by receiving the maximum amount from the same donor and having that same donor fund all candidates and all political parties in the maximum amount. So what they're basically in denial of is the possibility of a political oligarchy where big, which is what we have today, where big spenders and big donors are drastically more influential than everybody else put together.
And we should also say, let's put an asterisk on there because they didn't know about Bob McDonnell at the time. But this is where we are at this point. And I mean, from your perspective, is this been just basically a question of partisanship or ideology or some mix of both?
I'd say it's a mixture of both. Clearly, the justices, as removed as they are from the political fray in terms of having lifetime appointments and not having to worry about their salaries or their jobs, they're political animals, and they wouldn't have been, in most cases, nominated and appointed if they weren't sufficiently politically sensitive, right, to the needs of their party. And so there's that. You know, they understand that the distributive consequences of their holdings, they understand that they favor the political forces that put them there to begin with. And you see a great deal, except for cases like Souter. I mean, the exceptions are so notable where you get, say, Justice Souter or Chief Justice Rehnquist, who from time to time don't toe the party line. They're notable. And there was a saying of no more Souters, right?
That, right.
Republicans wanted to avoid at any cost a justice who could be that independent so as to not come out their way. So there can be a degree of partisanship, but that's built in to any model of politically appointed judges. And it's probably worse in the case of elected judges. So we're never going to get around that. The parts that we can get around, there are two of them. One of them is having a constitution that's completely silent on political finance and money and politics. So that kind of a constitution gives carte blanche to any judge, not even just the Supreme Court justices, but any federal judge or even the state judges who have all sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution. So that's a problem. Whether you're progressive or conservative, you don't want your foundational document to be silent on one of the key pieces of what democracy means, right? So that's one thing. The other thing that I think we can control and need to have input on is this sort of bizarre free market ideology run amok. Because even if you're a free marketeer and you're the way you understand the world is investment and markets and competition, you should hate this case law. I mean, especially if that's the way you see the world, because it doesn't make sense to have this kind of a case law which routes economic competition into political spending and then brings legislative privileges and tariffs and subsidies and earmarks and so on back into the economic sphere and corrupts capitalism. It just doesn't make sense if you're a free marketeer to support democracy as a market. Because if democracy is a market, then you're not going to have free markets in the economy.
All right. So let me just translate these two obstacles, as you note them. One is that our Constitution just simply did not contemplate the idea that people would be spending $1 billion in the presidential election or millions of dollars to elect their congresspeople. And so that silence makes it much easier for someone, for a judge or a justice to claim First Amendment absolutism in this realm. And the other is if you were a genuine a conservative sort of libertarian type, and I'm smiling as I say this because of my experience in never finding that person. but you who rails at the corruption of government from large corporations, which I think is an accurate assessment. Their I guess prescription for that is to shrink the government so it doesn't have the leverage to be worthwhile to be corrupted. So this is essentially, you know, freedom. You would theoretically want money not to be able to corrupt your politics so that you wouldn't have unnecessary licensing of industries or subsidies or the Import-Export Bank or that type of thing. Those people are notably silent on any type of campaign finance restrictions. So where does... Yeah. So let's go back to one where we have a constitution that is silent. Do you favor a constitutional amendment? And I have to say that it's actually, there's been just the other day, I think Don Hazen at Alternate wrote, and I've seen, you know, other sort of progressives who see campaign finance as a problem has written that it's either delusional or even dangerous, perhaps, to push for a constitutional amendment at this point. Give me your take on that, at least from a legal standpoint, and then from a practical standpoint.
Sure. From a legal standpoint, I think there's clear analogies to a potential amendment on money in politics. We're dealing still and forever in this country with a legacy of political exclusion. We began the republic with slavery, and we, even before eliminating slavery, of course, we eliminated the property requirement that prevented white males without property from voting. So, and that didn't take a constitutional amendment, but that took a massive push. And, you know, you can look at Andrew Jackson's legacy as really consisting in that and opening up democracy to all white males, which was a tremendous challenge. And you've got Doors Rebellion in Rhode Island and things like that. So, you know, up until about 1840 or so, our problem was exclusion of white males without property. And then 1865, you get the abolition of slavery in an amendment, the 13th, due process and equal protection in an amendment, the 14th, black suffrage in the 15th Amendment, female suffrage in the 19th Amendment. Even the abolition of poll taxes took a constitutional amendment in 1964. I see those steps in U.S. history as analogous, legally speaking and culturally speaking, to what is required in the case of money in politics. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to eliminate the property requirement for the vote and to eliminate poll taxes and to eliminate political exclusion of all these other kinds to come to a moment now in the sort of hyper-capitalist stage where you've got to be a millionaire or a billionaire to have any real influence.
The property owners and the poll tax seem to me to be most on point because those are the most explicitly economic. And we don't have a federal constitutional right to vote, do we? I mean, is that the property owners and the poll tax are sort of based on equal opportunity as opposed to a standing right to vote? Is there? I mean, the Constitution's fairly silent in regards to voting, isn't it?
There's the guarantee of Republican government, which is a representative form of government, and that's in there that the federal government, the Constitution guarantees that to the states. Clearly, when you look back at our history, there was no universal right to vote ever, and you know that by virtue of the suffrage requirements on, you know, the property requirements, you know that by slavery, you know that by female exclusion, and so on. I mean, I would talk about it really more in the context of the 1960s and the legacy of Martin Luther King, Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Acts as being our primary legal material in this way. But, you know, of course, the issue these days isn't the right to vote. It's the right to vote in a republic, right, which is a representative form of governance. If your elected representatives aren't accountable to you as a geographic constituent, that's a real problem. So what we see today is the vote has been reduced to a referendum on the market-dominant candidates. You can't vote for the other people. They haven't made it. They haven't been able to mount a viable campaign. They haven't gotten the support of any major party in order to gain any sort of prominence. So the vote is very analogous to going and buying breakfast cereal at the supermarket. You can only buy the ones that they've decided to stock on the shelves, which are the ones who have found funding and incorporated and become a company and produce cereal. And politics is the same way.
And that's a corruption of the process sort of at large. So, all right. So from a legal standpoint, there's precedent here. From a practical standpoint, it's much harder, isn't it?
From a practical standpoint, it is much harder. But I would note that all of the major accomplishments that I've mentioned in passing between between Jacksonian democracy and the abolition of slavery up until the Voting Rights Act were not easy propositions either. And, I mean, the fact that it's not easy is a testament to just how important it is and just how necessary it is. I mean, if it were easy, we would have done it already and it wouldn't be that big of a deal. I mean, the fact is our entire system, our entire culture now is becoming premised on monetary power, and we need to address that. As a polity, as a political unit, we have to address that. As a community, if we want to be a community of political equals with a representative government, we have to address that. And the tremendous irony in all of this is that the United States understands its historical mission and importance as the country that defeated aristocracy, right, where political power was premised on royal birth and there was no popular sovereignty. It was the sovereignty of the monarch. We understand our whole historical importance as uprooting that model, defeating it in battle, and establishing a government of the people, for the people, by the people. And then we understand our importance in terms of defeating communism, where it was the party, the Communist Party, that dominated politics and the economy. And we defeated, we like to think that we defeated communism. And yet, you go from one form of oppression with aristocracy and communism, you go then straight to plutocracy in a way. Is our country really standing for meaningful democracy, or are we standing for capitalists dominating people who don't hold capital? And that's where the economic studies come in. You read Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, and many of the other economists writing in this country, not France, are all finding the same things, which is that we're becoming an oligarchic sort of society where people who own capital are gaining much higher returns than people who depend on wages, and the power of capital is only increasing and becoming more and more aggregated. And so eventually, we'll have the right to vote, but you won't control anything in terms of the terms that you agree to for getting any corporate service or good. And you'll be so economically disadvantaged that it'll hardly matter, because your politicians are accountable to those who've got the money to fund their campaigns and to maintain their super PACs.
And what of the opportunity for, say, one or two justices to switch? I mean, we've been talking about 5-4 splits.
Yeah.
And, there was even talk after the 2012 election that perhaps it wasn't beyond the pale that the Supreme Court would revisit Citizens United just based upon the explosion of money. You see Sheldon Adelson single-handedly changed the direction of the Republican primary, for instance. What of just simply a new Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, that could happen, or it might not happen, but let's assume it does happen. Okay, let's assume, 4 or 8 years from now, or maybe sooner, maybe President Hillary Clinton gets to replace, Justice Scalia or somebody like that. So that's a temporary thing. So first of all, there's no guarantee that they'll come out the way you expect them to,
right?
Because they do have total judicial independence once they're in office. But the other thing is, even if they do come out the way you'd hope and they overrule Citizens United and they overrule McCutcheon, how long is that going to last? Another 10 or 20 years until the conservative free market ideologues are back in power and they've got their own justices restacking the court? That kind of back and forth is just completely unacceptable when you're talking about the foundation of our democracy and the foundation of our economy. You can't have a good sustainable, accessible form of capitalism if you can't have common sense regulation. And you can't have common sense regulation if your politics have been captured by wealth.
And so lastly, so give me a sense of what that constitutional amendment would be. And one of the things that I hear raised that is one of the only sort of valid, in my estimation, sort of caveats is, what do you do about the fact that our media is owned by these corporations? I mean, how do you draw the lines here?
Yeah, I mean, I personally haven't studied the media question in sufficient depth, so take this with a grain of salt. But I would like to see a form of corporate law that didn't allow corporate consolidation of media companies, didn't allow corporations that are really dedicated to, automobiles or oil or whatever it is, also having subsidiaries or all of these interests in media corporations. I think the media corporation, if it really is going to be the third estate, and if it really is going to play this vital role in democracy, the opinions of media corporations need to be more independent than that. So the media corporation should not just be a front for the economic interests of some other kind of corporation. So I would like to see a massive reform in the area of law governing media consolidation. But that's not something I write on, and please take that with a grain of salt. I mean, it's simple to have a media exemption. That's not hard to do, and existing law even has that. I would maintain a media exemption. I would seek reform of laws governing media corporations. But basically, the main thing you need to do is allow Congress the authority to limit donations and expenditures and overrule this idea of money as speech and corporations as having every bit as much of a right to that speech as Thomas Paine does. You really need to set that straight on the record within the text of the Constitution and restore congressional authority.
Timothy Kuhn, author of Capitalism versus Democracy, Money in Politics, and the Free Market Constitution. We will link to it at on our site at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. It's that time where we head into the fun half. We have a studio audience today. Our friend Aaron from TYT, home headquarters, well, actually a satellite headquarters, is with us. And he is reminding me to remind you that we cannot do this show without your support. Become a member today at majority.fm or go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member. It's so easy. It is pennies a day. And it allows us to continue to bring you great material. Coming up in the one of the next 2 days, I believe, we will have Chris Hayes on the program to talk about his the piece that he wrote, I guess it was about a month ago, in The Nation about climate change in anticipation of the big climate people's march that I believe they're having around the world. But the big one's going to be in New York City. It's going to start at about 11:30 a.m. I'm already marshaling my children. We will be out there. It runs from on the west side of Manhattan from, I believe, the 80s down to maybe the 30s or 40s on the west side. So that's happening this weekend. We're going to take a break. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, folks, do you buy crap from Amazon? If you do, you must, at the very least, go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy your Amazon crap through that. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com, JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. It makes a great gift. It's a great way to turn people onto the show. Hey, what's this great coffee you've given me? Well, it's from JustCoffee.coop. What's this MR on the front on the front of it. Well, that's the Majority Report. That's what you should be listening to every day on your smartphone. Get the app at majorityapp.com. All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. In the fun half, Rush Limbaugh will explain to you that sometimes no means yes, but only if you know how to spot it.
It's a game of spotting.
I can spot it. I can spot it.
That sounds like Alex Jones spotting something over there, man.
I can spot it. I haven't heard any of these guys line up. I don't know what happened.
See, the female has a computer chip that was inserted.
The male. What is the name of this product?
Male Vitality.
Super Male Vitality.
Super Male Vitality. Now, I didn't plan this, but I just noticed that...
yesterday, she was saying no. Super Male Vitality
gives you the hearing...
And pheromones alone, now, that became a yes.
The government doesn't want you to know this. And I'm surprised I'm still alive to actually be able to tell you this. Super Male Vitality, what it does is it gives you the 25 by 25 eyesight and the equivalent hearing to determine when a no means yes.
I'd also like to add, in addition to being surprised that I'm alive, I'm surprised that I was just able to buy that home in Boca Raton, another Telluride, Colorado, and that my stock portfolio hasn't been stooped on or disrupted by
part of this
international
is part
agencies.
Of the international Illuminati. They're allowing me to buy these things, purchase these things, as a way to hide their real agenda. More when we come back.